You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong tokingua. E whakarongo ana koe ki te waia marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, tērā te kumatahi a whiringa a rangi. Kia ora, you're tuned in to 95 BFM and this is the Thursday Wire for today, November 11th, and I'm Justin Wong. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, we have our weekly chat with Health and GCSB Minister Andrew Little. There has been a sharp increase in COVID-19 specific disinformation and other forms of dangerous speech and disinformation since the Delta outbreak in New Zealand, says a study at Auckland University. The GCSB spy domes at Waihopai and South Island will be retired next year. Justice Minister Chris Farfoy said the three strikes law will be striked out. And a Victoria University report said local leaders and planners can reduce risks from coastal threats without waiting for law reform. As usual, he aha o whakaro, let me know what you think. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text me on 5395 or wai mai rane. Give me a call on 309-3879 if you want to talk anything that's on your mind today. Ko wa e waere waere, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki marunga i te paitukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM ira katsikom. As always, you can catch all these stories and previous shows on the 95BFM through BCAS. I tēnā wā tonu. Now let's have a chat with the Health Minister.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
This week, with Health and GCSB Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about the decision to retire the spy domes at Waihopai and his recent comments saying the current home isolation system isn't set up for the current number of COVID-19 cases, as well as his criticisms against the Ministry of Health for not releasing individual data to the Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency. I began by asking if he still has confidence in the Director General of Health after these two incidences.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Organising the isolation, the home isolation process has been, that's been in place for a few weeks, but it's under pressure because the number of people who are getting infected and being confirmed each day is way bigger than people had planned for at this particular point. So it's just a process of making sure the system runs in as streamlined a way as possible, given the volumes that we've got. We'll iron those things out, and I have full confidence in the team to do that. And likewise, with the disclosure of data to the Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency, it is unfortunate that the Commissioning Agency had to go to court to get their issues aired and get the Ministry to reconsider its view. Anyway, it has done, and there's been a process in place also involving Te Arawhiti, as it turns out, to try and work out exactly what it is that is needed and therefore getting the disclosure underway. And I'm advised that information is now being disclosed that meets Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency's needs.
So why can't the home isolation system can handle more than 120 cases per day?
It will be able to, but it was the fact that one of the important organisations that gets notified of a positive test is the Public Health Unit, the Auckland Regional Public Health Unit that's up there. As well as having to do the follow-up for each positive test to check that the person is okay and suited to isolating at home as opposed to going into an MIQ facility. They've also got to do the broader contact tracing as well. Where have you been? What places? What other people have you mixed with and all that sort of thing? So they're trying to jam all those things together with volumes that had not been predicted as we were putting these things together. So it's about making sure that that there are changes to the process that means that we can get through the volume of work and the volume of calls that needed to be taken and the content of those calls. That process is underway and I'll get that fixed reasonably smartly.
But how long will these changes take? Because as you said yesterday to News Hub, the time it takes for public health officials to contact those who are positive will take up to 2 days or even longer, and that's not acceptable, is it?
Yeah, and I think in terms of evaluating somebody who's confirmed as having COVID and about whom an assessment needs to be made as to their suitability to isolate at home or go to an MIQ facility, that's got to be done within that first 24 hours. That is the commitment that is made when this process was being set up. So we've got to make sure that happens, and for a large part, I think it'll be prioritising, you know, what work has to happen first, what questions have to be asked first, and to some extent too, making sure that where people are identified as having said it is suitable for them to stay at home, arranging others, and often it'll be other healthcare providers, to swing in and provide care packs and make sure that the pulse oximeters are delivered and some education is given about how to use them and what have you. So it's just about allocating the work in a way that means it gets done as quickly as possible and people get attended to as quickly as possible.
But do you think the work of care is being adequate enough, considering that three people have already died while isolating at home?
I mean, we need to investigate and understand the full circumstances of each of those who have died at home. I mean, we know one of them had actually been in hospital and elected to discharge themselves, that there had been contact following their discharge, and there was then a very rapid deterioration and they unfortunately died. The other two cases, we just need to know what those circumstances are. But in any event, I mean, it is pretty obvious that if you've returned a positive test, you have COVID, then the system needs to swing in pretty smartly to make sure that you are getting the support and care that you need. If you have other health conditions, we need to know that. If you're in a household with a large number of people, we need to know very quickly, are you able to isolate away from those people safely, or do we need to find another place for you? So all those things need to be established very quickly, because otherwise, you know, the risk of infection of others becomes much greater. Or if you do have a bunch of other health conditions, or you are just rapidly getting unwell and we don't pick that up, then you're going to be at risk, and we need to make sure people aren't in that position.
Okay, but earlier you told us that back in October that ICU could handle a surge, well, and hospitals could handle a surge. And back then, when we talked about this topic, there were only around, I think, 500 or so active cases. But now there are almost 3,000 active cases. And if home isolation couldn't cope with 120 cases plus per day, how much could hospitals handle?
Well, it's interesting you raise that point. I think we should keep the issues about isolating at home and being careful in the community is separate from hospital and ICU capacity. So you're right, we have nearly 3,000 active cases. We have, as of 1 o'clock yesterday, I think about 70, just over 70 people in hospital, of which 5 were being cared for in ICU or HDU units. So the hospital system is coping with the demand, even with this rapid increase in the number of cases. The issue is, if you know, people do elect to, because it's suitable for them to do so, stay at home, to isolate at home, we still need to make sure that the care is in place and the monitoring is in place and that system is working. It's that system that we've, you know, been in the process of standing up over the last 4 or 5 weeks that has been, you know, put under real pressure, and we've just got to make sure that there aren't delays between the time that we get a notification of a person testing positive and their first call and that assessment about where it's most suitable for them to be isolating. That's the bit that we've got to get right. That's the bit that's been under pressure in the last few days, and now the team is working on getting that right.
Government recently approved the use of 2 COVID drugs. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so we now have a number of drugs, Ronapreve, baricitinib, and have now been approved for use. These are for when you do have COVID. They alleviate symptoms. They're very effective and have been proven very effective overseas. There's other drugs too. There's tocilizumab has been used. That's a drug that was previously widely used for arthritis. It's now widely used for COVID-19. And we have molnupiravir, which is an oral medication that has been approved, and we're getting 60,000 courses of those. All these drugs, because of their effectiveness in treating the symptoms of COVID, mean actually that people, you know, do recover more quickly. If their symptoms are so serious they're in hospital, they actually shorten their stay in hospital and become much less likely to have to, you know, have the more intensive levels of care. So they're very effective. We need to have a range of therapeutic treatments available, and we're building up our stock of treatments to do that.
Some people might think now, oh, there's a drug available, and why do we need the vaccine, though, maybe?
Well, I mean, what the vaccine does is that if you do get infected, you are much, much less likely to get very seriously unwell. If you are unvaccinated and you get the virus, then you have a much higher chance of becoming very unwell, struggling to breathe, and being in that state for several days, and perhaps even needing hospitalisation, as we're seeing with cases at the moment. So the vaccination is vital for making sure that if you do get COVID, you are much less seriously harmed by it. If you're not vaccinated, you're much more likely to be harmed quite seriously by the virus.
How soon can we see the drugs rolled out within the system?
Fairly soon. I mean, we've got advanced purchase agreements on most of the drugs. Pharmac has made the procurement decision. MedSafe has to give their approval, but these are drugs that are in use in other countries, and so there's plenty of data available for MedSafe to have a look at. My expectation is it'll be a matter of weeks before those drugs are here and widely available within hospitals, and it'll become part of our program of treating COVID.
Okay, moving away from COVID for just a couple of minutes, and now let's talk about GCSB's decision to retire Waihopai. The statement coming from Andrew Hampton said the domes at Waihopai are obsolete. Why is that?
I think it is just the domes that are being retired, by the way, not the whole facility. The facility does a number of other things than just picks up what the dishes and the domes do. The reality is the amount of intelligence that they are collecting is very, very small now. I think Andrew Hampton assessed it at roughly 0.5% of the intelligence that the GCSB gathers comes from the dishes and domes at Waihopai. So, technology is changing all the time. The GCSB is shifting the various platforms that it's on and that it uses to gather intelligence, and that's just become a very, very small and almost trivial part of their intelligence collection. So in those circumstances, it makes sense to retire them.
What kind of job does these domes do? What sort of communications do they intercept?
Satellite communications, that's what they're kind of scanning the skies for. So they pick up those forms of communications. But the reality is, in terms of communications of interest, less and less is available through that sort of platform, and more is gathered through other platforms. And so therefore the GCSB shifts their technology and their activities to the areas where there's more fertile ground for intelligence gathering.
So the other GCSB listening post in Blenheim will still be operational?
They have a facility there for data and intelligence processing, so that will continue there, yes.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Ko te waia, tēnei marunga, irirangi poho, and that was Labour and that was Health and GCSB Minister Andrew Little. And you're listening to the Thursday Wire on 95 BFM. Text me on 5395 or call me on 3093879 if anything that happens to be on your mind. It's up to 20 past 12 here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after a break.
New Leaf Kombucha is New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom.
Everything you need from your kombucha. 5 different varieties on tap, even more in bottles, all brewed organically with no flavourings, colourings or preservatives.
Try their new Hot Butcher, New Leaf's trademark dark non-alcoholic beer brewed with Kiwi hops. Everything you love about beer without the beer.
New Leaf Kombucha, New Zealand's only pure kombucha taproom. Visit today at 37 Crummer Road, Grey Lynn. Door sales only during level 3. Also, they've got a talking parrot. Come on!
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Durbage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
A recent study published by the University of Auckland has highlighted how dis- and misinformation has spread throughout communities since the beginning of the COVID-19 outbreak. The study, which began in February 2020, analysed various social, mainstream and other forms of physical and digital media to see how disinformation and misinformation is transmitted across platforms. In addition, the study also showed how since the beginning of the Delta outbreak back in August, there has been a sharp increase in COVID-19 related misinformation being spread throughout New Zealand. Our producer Joe Wickens talked to Kate Hannah, one of the project researchers, on what is the study about.
Tell me about the research paper which you were involved in, which looked at mis and disinformation in Aotearoa.
Well, at the beginning of the pandemic, we realised pretty quickly that misinformation and disinformation were going to be a key part of any kind of pandemic response. That was apparent right in February 2020. So we started collating publicly available data from social media and mainstream media to look at what the kind of patterns of misinformation and disinformation related to COVID-19. One of the things we found really quickly was that in often cases, misinformation or disinformation related to COVID-19 was also linked to other features of what we might call conspiratorial thinking or extremist or fringe ideologies or sets of beliefs. And so we started collating that data as well because there was this clear link. And then over the course of the pandemic, now we're sort of 20 months into it, we noticed that the links from COVID-19 specific disinformation or vaccine disinformation to these more fringe ideas was becoming shorter. So you, it would only take two or three clicks or maybe one click to get from a COVID-19 specific piece of disinformation or misinformation to material that was blatantly transphobic or homophobic, conservative in terms of its structuring of gender roles in society, or containing far-right or QAnon or white supremacist content. So the paper we've just released looks at what has happened over the last 12 weeks of the Delta outbreak, because what's happened during that time period has been an acceleration of that rate of change. So it's even quicker now to get from talking about COVID-19 on social media to talking about ideas about the role of the state, the role of the government, the role of the individual, many of which are encased in far-right language. And so we wanted to explore that and kind of publicise that so that New Zealanders would be aware of what's going on.
On Tuesday, there was another lockdown protest which occurred in Wellington. Based on your research, would you say that this is an indication that misinformation is much too prominent in society?
Yeah, so what we've seen is that ideas and conceptualizations around gender roles, around race, around societal structure and around sort of state versus individual responsibilities, which are linked to a range of ideologies, including white supremacist or far-right ideologies and also QAnon or conspiratorial thinking, have kind of shifted from being in the fringes, on platforms, say, that most people don't go to, to being, as you say, in public eye, in the public space, the Auckland Domain or at the Beehive, and also discussed in on mainstream platforms like Facebook and Instagram. So that is a shift of ideas from the fringes into the centre, which is obviously concerning because some of these ideas, as I say, have a really strong racialised and gendered conceptualisation of who is a New Zealander and who gets to be in charge or who gets to make decisions. We've also, as you said, seen conservative faith-based ideas be preeminent in this space. And there is a political sense that this is an attempt to change the nature of the discourse from being, an expression of pluralistic, inclusive, socially cohesive political spaces into exclusive, singular sets of ideas and socially divisive political spaces. And that's the kind of rhetoric that we're seeing at protests. I mean, I'm sure that many people listening will have seen that there was a lot of references to the Nazi Party and to swastikas, etc. Now, what's interesting is that generally when people are anti-fascist, they may display a swastika with a line, big red line through it in their protesting. Now, these people are accusing the government or the state of behaving like fascists, but they're displaying the insignia in an unedited way, shall we say. And so what that does is actually, violate our public discourse. It's terribly traumatic. We have Holocaust survivors in New Zealand.
I want to touch on the comparisons between lockdown and things such as the Holocaust and apartheid. What are your thoughts on this referencing?
Yeah, I mean, it's a salient observation to sort of say that, the casual referencing, there should never be casual referencing of the Holocaust or apartheid. Those are not events in human history that should be bandied around and thrown out there as symbols that you can use and reuse and for your own purposes, and in doing so, it shows the lack of commitment to truth, to understanding the past, to understanding the present. That is a feature of people who produce disinformation narratives. I mean, the broader population of a community who are now participating, perhaps in these demonstrations and using these symbols, they are a community that have been dragged into this space by a small number of very vocal, very committed disinformation producers and sharers for whom the volatility that they've created is the end goal. They're less interested in vaccination or COVID-19 than they are in creating a sense of divisiveness and volatility that they can capitalise on for their own ends.
Do you think that the spread of misinformation has had a negative effect on the profession of journalism and the ability to produce informative, non-biased news?
Look, I mean, there's a lot of issues that are not, that are universally present around mainstream media and social media, and that is to do with an attention-based economy or an engagement-based economy, where both newspapers and social media platforms are looking for clicks, are looking for engagement and reader retention. That's widespread. But in New Zealand, we do have largely trustworthy and transparent media economy. Organisations are publicly owned, or the ownership model is New Zealand-based in many cases. there's quite a lot of transparency and being able to directly, you know who's involved with putting things together. That doesn't mean our media landscape is perfect, but it means it's a lot better than, say, a Murdoch media-dominated landscape in, say, Australia or the US. That said, the pushing towards volatility and divisiveness that's happening right now by these disinformation agents, including people who claim to be media outlets that are voices of truth, who are still promulgating, you know, disinformation and fake news, does suggest that we may go to a situation where some people are getting their news from those kinds of locations, and that would be a very bad thing for New Zealand's social and political landscape for the future if we had very partisan media.
And that was Kay Tanner from the University of Auckland talking to producer Joe Wickens. She also says that the issue of misinformation is concerning, but it's that New Zealand media has thought about how it can provide coverage of events such as lockdown protests without giving too much attention to the misinformative content. Moving on. The GCSB has said it will retire and remove the domes and satellite dishes at its Waihopai station in the South Island after 30 years of service. The GCSB's Director General, Andrew Hempton, said the dishes have reached the end of their service life and became obsolete under changes of global telecommunication and information technology. Mr. Hempton also said information obtained by the dishes at Waihopai only accounts for 0.5% of all intelligence produced by the Bureau last year. The minister responsible for the GCSB, Andrew Little, said in a statement retiring that the Waihopai satellite dishes does not diminish New Zealand's contributions to the Five Eyes partnership. The first of the two 18-metre dishes and radomes are expected to be removed next year, but the GCSB will continue to operate out of Waihopai station. Murray Horton is a campaigner of the anti-basis campaign that called for the closing of the stations at Waihopai and Tangimoana, and he has been attending annual protests outside the Waihopai base since it became operational in 1988. He spoke to me this morning from Christchurch.
Not surprised, because they are obsolete, their 1980s technology, but it doesn't make any difference to the central demand of the anti-basis campaign, of which I'm the spokesperson. Since the 1980s, we've consistently called for the Waihopai spy base to be closed, and essentially what Andrew Little, has, the minister in charge of the intelligence agencies, has announced is that they're simply closing down an obsolete part of that base, albeit the most physically visible part of it, the base itself, and actually another GCSB spy base at Tangimoana in the Lower North Island, are both going to continue. They'll simply use different types of spying.
Well, what about the other spy bases? Do you think they're also obsolete?
Tangimoana, I honestly, we haven't followed that. It's even older. It dates back to the 70s, and it fulfills a different function. Last time we looked, which was sort of intercepting signals from shipping. But, I mean, don't quote me on that, because we haven't done any research on it for a long time. Effectively, Waihopai is New Zealand's biggest contribution to the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, between the US, the UK, Canada, Australia and New Zealand. And anti-basis campaign says that not only should Waihopai be closed down, but New Zealand should get out of Five Eyes. And that the whole structure of Western intelligence of this Five Eyes thing is not overly useful in any sense of the word. And the most sort of conspicuous and spectacular example of that within the last 3 months has been the complete collapse and defeat of in Afghanistan. And Helen Clark, the New Zealand Prime Minister, who actually sent New Zealand troops into Afghanistan 20 years ago, was quoted as saying what happened in Afghanistan represented, quote-unquote, a catastrophic collapse or catastrophic failure of Western intelligence. And so the question has to be asked, if we've seen such a catastrophic failure of Western intelligence in a country that for 20 years was essentially an adventure playground for Western intelligence agencies, including the GCSB, why are we in it?
Well, but in your opinion, though, what sort of benefits would New Zealand get if we get out of the Five Eyes?
We'd have a genuinely independent foreign policy.
And
not one that's tied into sort of anyone else's empire, be that US or Chinese, for example. So we would actually have a country that would actually be able to set its own course rather than one that's dictated by people elsewhere. One of the interesting things that came out from the investigations into the mosque massacre here in Christchurch in 2019, the director of the GCSB, and I think it's the same one as now, Andrew Hampton, was quoted as saying they were not looking for sort of white nationalists, white supremacists, Nazi sort of people in New Zealand, because that was not the sort of priorities they were being asked to look for by their sort of big brothers overseas. The GCSB basically operates as a junior sort of contractor to the Western world's biggest electronic intelligence agency, namely the United States National Security Agency. And in the case of the mosque massacre and the inquiry held into it, the GCSB admitted that they were not looking in the direction of sort of white supremacist gunmen in New Zealand.
Well,
that was not what they were being tasked to spy on.
We spoke to Andrew Little earlier today, and he said New Zealand will be worse off without the intelligence collected by the GCSB because their insights would have foiled several terror attacks that haven't been publicly known. What do you think of that?
They always say that. I'll go back to what Helen Clark said, that what happened in Afghanistan represented a catastrophic failure of Western intelligence, not simply in New Zealand, but on a global scale. So they may have followed the, it wasn't GCSB spying that, for example, stopped more people being murdered in that knife attack in the supermarket in Auckland. It was sort of on the ground policing that sort of covered that angle of that sort of ISIS terrorist who set out to murder people in the supermarket, wherever it was. It was the fact that the cops were following him around, not the fact that the spies were following him or keeping an eye on him.
And are you still going to protest at Waihop High next year?
Absolutely.
Even with the domes out?
I don't know. The domes will be out by the end of January. But, I mean, yeah, there's still going to be a spy base there. I'm just about to sit down and put out a knock something together now. Well, I hope I will still be a spy base, simply not such a physically conspicuous one. And we're scheduled to be there, COVID permitting, on Saturday, January the 29th.
And that was Murray Horton from the Anti-Basis Campaign talking to me earlier this morning about the GCSB's decision to retire the satellite dishes and the domes at Waihop High Station. Moving on, the government said it will repeal the three strikes law, which was introduced in 2010 by the last national government and mandates judges to impose the maximum sentence to offenders who commit a third and serious crime. Labour had previously tried and failed to repeal the law in 2018 after being blocked by coalition partner New Zealand First. And today, Justice Minister Chris Farfoy said the law has not improved public safety and instead saw absurd sentences being imposed on offenders.
The three strikes law takes no account of things like mental health issues, and the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court have found that sentences imposed under the regime contravene the Bill of Rights Act. The Supreme Court just recently intervened in a case of a person with a long-standing serious mental illness to correct what the court said was a third strike sentence that was so disproportionately severe that it breached the Bill of Rights.
Mr. Farfoy also said even without the three strikes laws, judges would still be able to impose severe sentences on serious offenders, and they would be able to consider relevant factors such as mental health issues to tailor the penalty to fit the crime. Those who have been already sentenced under the three strikes law will continue to serve their sentence, but provisions for them could be introduced by Parliament at Select Committee. The Greens said it is delighted that the three strikes law is repealed, with the party's justice spokesperson Gorit Skaraman saying the law has led to grossly unfair results that disproportionately impacted Māori. The ACT Party's justice spokesperson Nicole McGee said the three strikes law deters violent offending and the repeal is another signal that the government is soft on crime. Ms. McGee also said the party has already launched a petition to keep the three strikes law. And on that, we will have another break, and it's almost 20 to 1.
Been saying you're sophisticated. You were waiting.
Music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
The November playlist features Marlon's Dreaming, Vanishing Twin, Carl Stephen, Wet Leg and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for a monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
What's his title? The guy in charge, Dr. Ashley Broom.
The Director General of Health.
Yeah.
The Wire.
On Tuesday, a study conducted by the Victoria University of Technology, Victoria University of Wellington, showed how coastal risks could be reduced, and now instead of waiting for legislation. The report comes timely with the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, as world leaders discuss how they can reach global emission reduction targets. The study's author, Judy Lawrence, says her research analyses the difficulties of planning for the ongoing sea level rise under a planning regime which is largely permissive and enables land users with very long timeframes. Producer Joe Wickens spoke to her.
Can you tell me a bit about your study's findings in regard to how local leaders and planners can tackle threats to our coast?
Okay. The purpose of the report was really to look at what councils were doing currently to adapt to climate change at the coast, and in particular sea level rise. And we found that some were doing quite well in preparing, preparatory to actually adapting, and undertaking studies, risk assessments, vulnerability assessments, and so on. Others were sort of delaying and waiting, and waiting until the issues about funding were sorted. And so the purpose of this report was really to see to what extent the provisions in the RMA, the Resource Management Act, could actually be used now to do the preparatory work before the legislation comes in, so that they get a good standing start. And we found that there were things that could be done now, for instance, better collaboration amongst councils to develop rules where to make it very clear that certain areas in New Zealand are not good places to be building houses, and so forth. So we found a number of provisions that could be used now so that they're prepared.
Based on your findings, what can councils and those in their position of leadership do in order to help address and get to work on this issue?
Yeah, well, the coastal hazards and climate change guidance came out in 2017, and that's now a national guidance under the Ministry for the Environment, and I was a co-author of that. And in that, councils have a lot of guidance as to how they can think about long-term climate change and the effect that that has on the sort of decisions they take today. So, for example, some councils have already identified the areas that are at risk. They've done risk assessments, and some have looked at a number of options for phasing in changes that in their plans that can control further development. They've identified hazard zones and so forth. However, the problem with sea level rise is that it's going to continue, and it'll continue inland in low-lying areas, and it's not going to stop. So when the planning's taking place, there's an adaptive approach where you can identify those sorts of options that can be maybe temporary in the meantime, and the plans can prohibit development behind those protections so that you don't get more intense development. Because in the end, seawalls and raising houses and filling land are not going to be permanent. And because you won't be able to access the areas because only the building sites will be raised. So you've got some problems long term. And if the councils that are getting ahead of the game now will be able to effect that change more quickly when the new legislation comes in, which is largely dealing with property issues, who owns the property when the fee comes in, and dealing with who pays for retreat of some areas or building of protection in other areas. So there's a big cost impost coming, and that needs to be sorted out in legislation. But there's a lot they can do in the meantime to get prepared and to do the planning now.
Now, we've seen attempts made to help manage this issue. However, these have been considered short-term solutions, which can lull people into a false sense of security. Are there any other ways this has happened?
Yeah, one particular way that's being used is filling the land. In other words, putting a lot of debris in soil and compacting it for foundations and effectively raising the land above sea level rise levels. And one of the problems with that is that you have to be able to get to the area. So if the area is in fact, you know, sitting on its own like an island, and the sea starts to rise and you get more flooding, it's just not going to be sensible long term. If you're investing a large amount of money into, say, public buildings or even houses, this is not a long-term solution. And so what we've suggested is in the guidance is that this dynamic adaptive pathways planning enables you to identify the actions you can take now that enable you to make adjustments further in the future. And that has been adopted by some councils already. Marlborough District Council have put that in their regional coastal plan. They haven't got rules in yet, but they've got the basis for undertaking that activity with communities. And so communities can understand that this is not something that you can just put a wall up and the problem will go away.
And that was producer Joe Wickens talking to Judy Lawrence from Victoria University of Wellington. And the study conducted by Judy and her team will ultimately look to provide recommendations for greater collaborations between regional and district councils on consistent use of information and methods and the application of regional rules that have immediate effect to control land use change and development.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire for today, November 11th. Nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero ki, me kia mātou mō tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We had Health and GCSB Minister Andrew Little, the University of Auckland's Kate Hannah, Victoria University of Wellington's Judy Lawrence, and the anti-basis campaign's campaigner Murray Horton. E whakarongo ana koe, and also a big thank you to my producer for today, Joe Wickens. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi poho, you're listening to 95BFM. Johnny and Beck Hungry will be with you at 4, but now I'm handing you over to Sigrid for the next 3 hours. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki, and I'll see you next week. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.